where did we come from? How did the universe come into being? Are we alone in the universe? All my life, I have sought to understand the universe.
Yeah. Bad boy, baby. Loon.
It's your turn now, Marco, here on Astrotalk. You're listening to Astrotalk, CITR's weekly astronomy talk show with your host, Marco.
Good afternoon, this is Marco on CITR 101.9, and you're here with Astrotalk, the weekly astronomy talk show. So what's happening in astronomy today? Well, there's lots. There's Fermi helps link cosmic neutrinos to blazar blasts. A Russian doll galaxy cluster is revealed. And Curiosity Mars rover crosses rugged plateau. So there's still exploration on Mars. There's lots of rovers. And there's lots of new discovery with the Hubble Space Telescope. NASA's Hubble discovers a moon orbiting a dwarf planet, Makemake. Makemake. Is that the name? Is it Makemake or Makemake? Okay, this is astronomers using the Hubble Space Telescope discovered a moon orbiting a dwarf planet, Makemake, the third largest known object past the orbit of Neptune, about two-thirds the size of Pluto. So it's a dwarf-like planet called Makemake. I didn't know about that. So that's in our solar system. Further observations of this moon may allow astronomers to calculate Makemake's mass, which will give them, I guess they have a rough estimate, it's two-thirds the mass or size of Pluto, but they don't know the mass. So exactly. So this moon will give them a better idea of the planet's density and its bulk composition. The Hubble Space Telescope has been instrumental in studying our solar system. Well, welcome. Today, I guess I'm going to continue talking about Kip Thorne's book, Black Holes and Time Warps. So there was a lot of people involved in the evolution of black hole theory, and Kip Thorne was one of them. So he was here last week, and I got his autograph. No, 2 weeks ago. He autographed my book I bought in 1994. So I have been a fan for 22 years. So let's talk about Kip Thorne's book a little more. Last week I was talking about the world wars and how a lot of the physicists and a lot of the resources of all countries involved, whether it was Russia, Germany, or America, they were diverted to weapons research. And in particular, at this point in the 1940s, it was diverted to making the bomb. So the atomic bomb, and the Americans made them and tested them, and then they dropped them on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So after that, after World War II, there was a rush to develop the super bomb, which is the hydrogen bomb. The two atomic bombs dropped on Japan were fission bombs. That means to create the nuclear explosion, a neutron was shot at a uranium atom, and the uranium atom would break apart into two constituent atoms and release energy, and it would trigger a chain reaction. So the search for the super bomb, or how to make the super bomb after the atomic bomb, was an intensive one. It was a race between Russia and America. Even though Russians kept it secret, the Americans didn't know about this. So even though the Russians kept it secret, the Americans were creating their own super bomb. So this was a fusion bomb where four hydrogen atoms would be fused to make one helium atom, and in the process large amounts of energy would be released. So super bombs or hydrogen bombs could theoretically be millions of times the power of an atomic bomb. So it was dangerous to think the Soviets could get a weapon like that and then use it against the West. But what the scientists didn't know as they were developing these bombs, their computer models or the computer simulations where they simulated explosions of the material could be easily transferable for computer models for the implosion of stars. So what happened when a large star not our sun, not big enough, but a large star, it'd have to be maybe 3 or 4 times the size of our sun. It would then have enough mass to create enough pressure to squeeze the innards of the star after it went through the nuclear fusion process. When it got up to iron, there would be not enough energy, because energy is needed to be inputted to fuse iron together, so the star would collapse and implode. What was left, if it was between 1.4 and 3 solar masses, would be a neutron star. And what would be left after a larger implosion, so that's when all the material implodes, then it explodes, it rebounds. So a supernova is an implosion. What was left over after the implosion was greater than 3 solar masses, you'd have a black hole. So today, you ask a grade 1 or 2 student, they probably know how to explain what a black hole is. People know about neutrons, protons, things like that. But in World War II, all these things were not certain. And after the research, when the war ended, the physicists returned to their laboratories and their universities, and they continued research in astronomy. So what they were doing in the war and just after the war were trying to create a superbomb. So the fusion of hydrogen, 4 hydrogen nuclei would make a helium nuclei, and that would create a lot of energy, a far greater amount of energy than splitting a uranium atom, which was the basis of the atomic bomb in World War II. So when the scientists returned, they could easily transfer their computer methods to the study of stars and how they imploded. But there was a lot of disagreements. Well, could stars really implode all the way to nothingness? We take for granted that black holes exist, that once something goes past the black hole event horizon and into the singularity, it essentially exits our universe. So the singularity, the center of the black hole, is apparently an area of zero volume, infinite density though, infinite mass. So when physicists came to that number, infinity, it made them skeptical, especially in the 50s and 60s when they were trying to develop theories about black holes. So remember, in the 50s and 60s, we didn't have astronomy texts that were telling us about black holes. These had to be developed, the theories of black holes. And surprisingly, well, maybe not surprisingly, but 100 years after Einstein's publication of his general theory of relativity in 1916, 100 years later, which is now, the theory is probably more useful, more in use than it's ever been. So Einstein, was he 100 years ahead of his time? Well, when the physicists were trying to talk about black hole theory, for example, in 1939, Oppenheimer and Schneider, 2 prominent physicists, calculated the implosion of a spherical star. So their equations spoke out loudly. Nobody really could grasp it then, but they were talking about things that would exit our universe. Once a black hole was made, everything would exit the universe. There were no equations to describe what happens inside a black hole. Only physicists can say something would be stretched infinitely long and squeezed infinitely thin. Once it entered the event horizon, it would cease to exist. Space and time, apparently, ceases to exist in the singularity of the black hole. So the event horizon is the area surrounding the black hole where, once something enters past that event horizon, it can no longer come back out, can no longer escape. So if we had a telescope where we could see something entering a black hole, all of a sudden it would disappear. There's this black edge. So once you get inside the event horizon, then there's quite a distance to the center where the singularity is. So again, the singularity is a space of infinite density, and apparently zero volume. So this tested physicists' instincts, because usually when physicists or mathematicians, when they solve an equation and it gives the answer of infinity, well, something's wrong. It doesn't really make sense. So we're going to talk about a black hole that we're following in Kip Thorne's book. And he is the father of black holes, but I guess Kip Thorne was mentored by many prominent physicists before, and one of them I'll talk about is Roger Penrose, who first studied mathematics and then was drawn into physics. And through his use of mathematics, he could use the mathematics of topology to really talk about what happens inside a black hole. Did I just say that correctly? Well, anyway, to describe what happens once you enter a black hole. And Einstein himself had to be tutored in mathematics to develop his theory of general relativity, to develop his about the gravity of space-time. So space-time's an awkward thing. It's really weird. It's something we don't deal with because we are not in an area of high gravity, and the sun is quite far away. It's got a lot of gravity, but it's very far away from us. And we on Earth, at least I haven't, never reached the speed of light. So we're talking about things that happen in areas that we have no relevance to us, because I guess a jet would be the fastest something could travel on our planet, or a rocket booster, 27,000 miles an hour or something like that. So now let's talk about black holes. Okay, so now we're going to talk about what happens inside a black hole. So after another one of my heroes, Chandra Shekhar, I think his name was Subrayama Chandra Shekhar, when he took his boat trip, I think around World War I, to go to London to study physics, on his boat trip, he calculated that past a certain mass, if a star had a certain mass, at the end of its life cycle, nothing could stop its collapse. He was talking, I think, about a neutron star, but later this was extended to black holes. So he was talking about something that people had no inkling of, and it wasn't a popular term. So, for example, grade 1, grade 2, grade 3 students can tell us what a black hole is. They know what neutrons are. They know what protons are. Scientists back then didn't have this knowledge. They had some knowledge, and they had some inklings about, let's say, neutron. But I think it wasn't until 1946 that Enrico Fermi gave the definitive data that said this is a neutron. So there was a lot of things that scientists didn't know about. But in 1939, two scientists, Oppenheimer and Snyder, calculated the implosion of a spherical star. So what happened later, a lot of physicists, particularly in Russia, said this could not happen. Star could not implode and form a singularity because of certain irregularities that said that would prevent the star from doing so. So in the after-war years, in the 40s, or after the 40s, after they finished playing with their bombs and calculating and making their bombs, physicists returned to their laboratories. And in the 1950s, they were wrestling with Einstein's equations to seek the secret of what's inside a black hole. Was it a route to another universe? What was it, a singularity? Was inside the black hole, was there a singularity with infinite tidal gravity? Was it the end of space-time and the birth of quantum foam? So there was a lot of questions physicists were grappling with, and many of them felt, well, to get these solutions, to solve these problems, we have to marry quantum mechanics with general relativity. So I'm going to pause now. I'm going to take a break. And when we come back, I'm going to talk more about Kip Thorne's book and his genius on things to do with black holes. This is Marco. You listen to Astro Talk on 101.9.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, B crime racketeer. Back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Exploding Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Let's do some quick yes or no questions. Are the following things technically possible? Life on other planets, is that theoretically possible?
Yes.
Okay. What about a Schwarzschild wormhole?
Yes.
Okay, what about this? Me going on a date with Charlize Theron?
No.
Well, not at all? In no universe?
No.
In none of the infinite universes does that happen?
No.
It's completely beyond the bounds of scientific possibility, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Quick follow-up question. In any of those potential universes, am I the one rejecting her and that's why it doesn't work out?
No. You do realize that typing your response is difficult for me, correct?
Okay, sure, yeah. It's just I'm trying to play this out because I'm just trying to see if there was any hypothetical hope.
No.
It doesn't matter. But never say never. Okay, if time travel were possible, would you want to go back in time and refuse to do this interview?
Yes.
You truly are an incredibly smart man. Stephen Hawking, thank you so much for your time.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only...
That's it. Pack it up.
You're listening to Astro Talk with Marco on CITR 101.9.
Welcome back. This is Marco on Astro Talk, and I'm not alone. No, there's not aliens in the room. There's Nick in the room with me. Hi, Nick.
Hey, I may be an alien.
Yeah, so Nick's in the room with me, so I'm not alone. So anyway, we're getting back to our talk about black holes. So as I said before, there's many things in our universe that the scales of distance, the speed, the gravity, the mass that we have nothing to relate to on our Earth. For example, a jet fighter is probably, or a rocket of NASA is probably the fastest anything goes on our Earth. But our concepts of time, mass, everything have nothing in common with some of the things that when we're dealing with black holes, we have infinite mass, infinite gravity, space-time is infinitely warped. So things we cannot imagine. And as something approaches a black hole, its gravity pulls it far quicker and quicker in. So the speed of light, it gets quicker or closer to the speed of light, something we really cannot relate to on Earth. So I'm going back to the 1939s when people were just, well, World War II was starting and some physicists were talking about black holes, but there was no textbooks to look at. Well, was there a black hole textbook in 1939? No, there wasn't. There was a lot of theories that scientists were trying to throw around, but a lot of scientists didn't agree with certain theories about black holes. And even Einstein himself would originally conclude, well, how can something squeeze itself out of existence? How can a black hole form? Even though his equations told him that, and his equations told him the universe expanding, he couldn't fathom it. So we're going back into a time where right now we have all this knowledge of what is a neutron, what is a proton, what is an electron, what's a black hole, what's a neutron star. We've all heard of them, but in the 40s and 50s, it wasn't something that was accepted by scientists. And I doubt people would have believed that something could squeeze itself out of existence, like what apparently happens in the center of a black hole, in the singularity. So in 1939, Oppenheimer and Snyder, they made calculations of the implosion of a spherical star. In their answers were contained equations that they published, and these equations spoke very loudly. then the equation said that after creating a black hole horizon, the spherical star continues imploding inexorably to infinite density and zero volume, whereupon it creates and merges into a space-time singularity, where once it goes in, nothing can come out. Space-time ceases to exist in the singularity. So the singularity is a region of space where the curvature of space-time becomes infinitely large, and space-time ceases to exist. So once something goes in, it can't come out. And the singularity would have infinite tidal gravity. So we know tidal gravity because the moon pulls on us, and we have tides in our oceans. So a singularity is a point. Zero volume, believe it or not, that's what physicists say, apparently. A region where gravity stretches all objects, and in some directions it'll squeeze them infinitely long, and along other directions it will squeeze them infinitely thin. So, there are several types of stretches and squeezes, which, if you're a PhD in the theory of black holes, you probably know about this. I don't, but anyway, there's several types of infinite squeezes and infinite stretches. So, imagine an astronaut falling feet first into a black hole. Now, Kip Thorne, in his book, to give the astronaut a longer chance to survive, for some reason says if the black hole was bigger, then the astronaut will survive longer as he falls into the black hole. So he gave the black hole a mass of 10 billion suns. So here we have a black hole. It's 10 billion sun mass. It's apparently infinitely dense at its center. It has zero volume at its center, which is a singularity, but it has an event horizon beyond which anything that goes inside there will never come out again. So all of a sudden, if we could see the lip of the black hole, all of a sudden we see blackness. There's nothing. So once the astronaut crosses the event horizon, Kip Thorne in his book said, well, let's make this 20 hours before his final death. So the astronaut will die. There's no way this astronaut can come out. So when Kip Thorne did his problem about falling into a black hole, or maybe I think when he was here 2 weeks ago, he talked about when the two big black holes merged. So he said, here's my wife, and she's in this vicinity. So either the astronaut's going to be falling into the black hole, or it's possible that Kip Thorne's wife will be falling into the black hole. So let's make it Kip Thorne's wife. I'm sorry, Dr. Thorne, and I'm sorry for your wife, but your wife is falling into a black hole. But Kip Thorne's a nice guy. He said, I'll make it a 10 billion solar mass black hole so his wife will survive longer. So I could have read why this happens, but I didn't. So I might tell you next week. Okay. So as Kip Thorne's wife crosses the vent horizon 20 hours before her final death, she is still too far from the singularity to feel its infinite tidal gravity. 1 second, though, before entering the singularity. So the Kip Thorne's wife has crossed the event horizon. She has gone towards the black hole, the singularity at the center. So let's make it 19 hours, 59 minutes, and 59 seconds after she has crossed the vent horizon, she will begin to feel the black hole's tidal gravity. So 1 second before entering the singularity, the tidal gravity stretches Kip Thorne's wife hand and feet apart. So 1/100th of a second before entering the singularity, her bones and flesh are ripped apart. I'm sorry to hear that. And then the last 1/100th of a second, Kip Thorne's wife's body gets infinitely distended. Now that would be awful, wouldn't it? Then, according to general relativity, she becomes part of the singularity. So all of a sudden, she is part of the singularity. So I think, also, I talked about this before last year when I talked about neutron stars. If we got ever close enough to, or got close enough to a neutron star, it would suck us onto its surface. We would be like planted onto the surface. So probably a film of matter that's an atom thick. So when you play with black holes or or neutron stars, they are dangerous. Lots of gravity. So now, the last 100th of a second, her body gets infinitely distended. Then, according to general relativity, Kip Thorne's wife has now become part of the singularity, which is a very sad thing. So she does not exist anymore. She is out of our universe. So that apparently what happens. I'm not sure if it happens passing the event horizon. I thought it did before, but I don't want to say if this is the case because it might not be correct. But for sure, once you go to that singularity, you're part of the singularity, you cannot come out of the other side. In general relativity, there is no other side. Space and time cease to exist. So for example, if we had an analogy of a piece of paper, if an ant walks up to the edge, there's nothing past that edge. It's the same of a black hole at the event horizon. But the ant can go back. In the singularity, we cannot go back. Once we're inside that event horizon, there's nothing stopping this person, in this instant, Kip Thorne's wife, from falling into the singularity and ceasing to exist. So they become part of the singularity where there's infinite gravity, infinite tidal gravity, infinite curvature, or if that's what it's called. I'm saying these things, but it's possible that is not correct because physicists at this point, I believe they have no way to fully describe or accurately describe what would happen to a person when or if they fell into a black hole. So I'm going to get back to this on the other side of the break. So I'm going to break again. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about black holes and time warps. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Every Thursday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, where we bring you the Community Living Show. A full hour is produced by the disabled community, showcasing for BC self-advocates with lots of interesting and fun content, including some interviews from special guests with special needs. Join hosts Michael, Kelly, and friends every Thursday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming online at citr.ca. Because you've got a friend in community living and CITR.
And I got them too.
There isn't
anything. Say, baby. Don't get in no trouble.
No, we're just trying to win this dance.
Club. You're staying alive on 101.9 with Marco on AstroTalk.
We got the Refugees All-Stars, Rubber Devin in the club, Y Clef Jean.
Sean Dillard, Maria. Baby, I'm about to tear this one, my boy.
Look at here, look at shorty got back. Should I ask him for a dance? Hold on, there's too many in the wolf pack. And besides, dirty cats talking to her. Buying a fake furs and taking her to the fever.
Welcome, you're listening to CITR 101.9. It's Thursday, it's 3 o'clock, and it's time for another one half hour of astronomy talk with your host Marco on CITR's Astro Talk.
Ouija's, check the spelling, R-E-F-U-G-E. E, get the CD from Sam Goody. You ain't even close with the rhymes that you wrote. Don't be mad because you broke. Let me clear my throat.
You're listening to Astro Talk with Marco on CITR 101.9 FM.
Me, I'm eating mangoes in Trinidad with attorneys. Yeah. My food slang flow worldwide like a current. With the every spot where nobody got insurance.
Thank you, Rohit, for that beatbox. Anyway, we're back on Astro Talk on 101.9 with your host, Marco. I'm talking about black holes, and during the commercial break, I was thinking, wow, wouldn't it be great to be a theoretical physicist? You sit in your office, and you can say, Let's take someone that's not on my good side. I'm going to put him in a black hole and see what happens. And I'm going to see what happens as he crosses the Venn horizon and goes into the singularity. So I shouldn't have chosen Kip Thorne's wife to describe what happens to a person, because I know she must be a wonderful lady. Okay, I'm sorry, Mrs. Thorne, and I'm sorry, Dr. Thorne, but anyway, I'm going to continue. So we have an edge of paper. Let's say we have an edge of paper. An ant can go to the edge of the paper, look over and say, there's nothing there. The ant can go back. But once we go to the edge of a singularity, nothing can go back. Space-time ceases to exist. So once we get to that part, we're pulled in. There's everything is instantly destroyed, according to Einstein's theory of general relativity. So these were concepts that physicists were grappling with in the 50s, in the 40s, in the 60s. And some of the scientists couldn't come to terms with them. They had no books to look at. Well, what's the theory of black holes? So theories had to be made, and some theories were not accurate. I can remember when they were studying the atom. Well, I can't remember, but I can remember when I was studying about it, there was a plum pudding model where some scientists put forward a theory, or one scientist put forward a theory, I think it was Thompson, that the atom was like a plum pudding, So the nucleus was the pudding, and the plums were embedded in the nucleus, and apparently the plums were the electrons, so that was not correct. How many theories have not been correct? Well, many of them. But this is what scientists do. They rigorously examine all theories, and in this examination, they discover the truth. So the astronaut reaching the singularity, when they were talking about a black hole, they would be stretched infinitely long, infinitely squeezed to a zero size. So they were all things that scientists were trying to come to grips with. In the 1950s and the 60s, scientists were debating. There were two groups, one led by Wheeler in America, which said there's infinite gravity inside a black hole, zero volume. A second group from Russia, Kolafnikov and Mikhailovich Lifshov were saying, we don't agree with this. They saw the infinite stretching and squeezing as a warning that Oppenheimer's theories and Snyder's theories were not correct and could not be trusted. These physicists from Russia believed that Oppenheimer and Snyder were using idealistic assumptions or idealistic models, that once reality was brought into it, their theory could not be trusted. So Oppenheimer and Snyder model, according to the Russian physicists, the star must be precisely spherical, non-spinning, have uniform density, zero pressure, no shock waves, no ejected matter, or no outpouring of radiation. Kolifnikov and his cohorts in Russia explained these extreme idealizations were responsible for the singularity. So they said a singularity only existed in the theories because Oppenheimer and Snyder, in their idealizations, in their theories, this is what was responsible for the singularity. They said a singularity could not form because you cannot have an idealized situation that Oppenheimer and Snyder envisioned. But Oppenheimer and Snyder believed that there could be a singularity. Wheeler and his group, I'm very sorry about that, Dr. Wheeler, but the group was led by Wheeler, and they came up with the conclusions that there's infinite stretch, infinite squeeze inside a black hole, space-time is no longer exists anymore, and didn't have the laws of physics to describe it. What they concluded, Wheeler and his group, was general relativity failed inside a black hole. So Wheeler thought, though, that quantum mechanics should prevent the tidal gravity force from becoming truly infinite. But how? So he had his doubts about the infinite tidal gravity inside a singularity. So they were trying to marry the laws of quantum mechanics and general relativity in the hopes that they could describe what happened inside a black hole. So this would be called quantum gravity. So it was a progeny of the marriage of general relativity and Einstein's equations of general relativity and quantum mechanics. Could tell the laws of space-time curvature, but was that true? Who knew? This, though, Wheeler believed, would govern the singularity and might create new physical phenomena inside the black hole, phenomena unlike we have ever met. So here they were grappling with these theories in the 50s and the 60s, and on the other side of the world in Russia, they had different theories that a singularity could not form. And there was equations that were formulated in 1939 that were saying a star could implode, but that was still difficult for scientists to prove mathematically, or they didn't have a black hole book they could grab off their library shelf. So there was a lot of debate, and through all this, the truth emerged finally. But how did it emerge? So Kolesnikov and Levitov in the Soviet Union were talking about small perturbations in stars. So they would cause tiny alterations in the gravity, the pressure, the random amounts of gravitational radiation, which would affect the implosions to this predicted endpoint, which was a singularity. So these Russians believed these perturbations, these tiny alterations in the properties of a star will grow so large, it would prevent a singularity from forming. I think one of the theories they had was the atoms would go towards a singularity, but it would be slingshotted around and shot out the other side. But could it cross the event horizon again? So there was lots of debate, lots of discussion, and it's something they didn't know about. So, for example, we have entered a new era of, we have discovered, not we, the brilliant scientists in Hanford and in Louisiana, they have finally detected a gravitational wave. What will come out of this? Who knows? When they were first discovering the properties of an atom, for example, the energy levels, and first talking about quantum mechanics or general relativity hundreds of years ago, no one could have predicted then what would come out of these discoveries. So the same thing happens with gravitational waves. But this was happening in the 1950s and the 1960s. They were debating, well, could a singularity form? What exactly happens inside a black hole? What happens inside the event horizon? Well, I think we talked about it when Kip Thorne's wife crossed the event horizon and eventually fell into the singularity. We talked about what happened, but at that time, nobody knew. And I guess Kip Thorne's wife would be very pleased about that because she does not want to be the subject of this experiment. But anyway, so in 1962, Kip Thorne, who I have his book right here, he signed it. It's one of my prized possessions now. He joined Wheeler's team as a graduate student in 1962. The Russians at that time published their results that no singularity was possible. And they even said that an imploding star might bounce and re-explode. So they didn't really know. There was all conjecture. Physicists were conjecturing, if that's a proper word. They didn't know what happened inside a black hole, and there were competing theories of what would happen. For example, would a singularity form? Would space-time cease to exist? Things like that. So physicists at that point had no idea of what would happen. So I'm going to take a break now because I'm searching for my page. When I come back, we're going to talk more about black holes. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on 101.9 CITR.
Femme Concept.
You are listening to Femme Concept
with your hosts Eleanor
and Erica.
Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR.
On CITR Radio 101.9.
We play 100% FemCon.
100%.
It's a lot of FemCon.
It's a lot of FemCon. And you know what? Stick it to the man.
Just a young boy living in the hub city. Back in the days when Ice Cube and Easy had every talking about boy you can't.
This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9 on the west side at UBC.
Too short, bumped in every super's boat and told us all how to ride for the west coast. My people thinking maybe where you at, throw your gloves in the air and wave them like you just don't care. From LA to the Bay. All day, every day, any damn day. Take a look around, we got the whole world locked down. Going on and on, and don't stop, won't stop, can't stop, ride or die. That's why I put it down for the west side. That long ago, oh, no. We were still in 40s out the liquor store. Oh, no. Mama started tripping, so it's time to go. Mob to the park with the locusts. Everybody broke, smoking roaches. DJ Quick was the had every claiming he was from the CPT. Y'all remember? One time tried to clown. We had to burn this bitch on down.
Welcome back. This is Marco. I was, during the break, searching for my page 5 because I had five pages of notes. I can't find it, so I'm going to go on a little bit longer, but I'll have to cut this story short. So where were we? We were at a point where there was a debate on singularities and black holes. Could singularities form? Russian scientists were saying, like Kolifnikov, that the only reason that mathematically the Americans like Wheeler were with their proofs could say, well, yes, a black or a singularity could form, is because they were making idealized assumptions about the star. So if there was any perturbations, any irregularities in its pressure, in its density, in other things, then this was why they could theoretically describe a black hole forming, or sorry, a singularity forming with their mathematics, because their assumptions were idealized. And the Russians were saying, well, no, a singularity cannot form. So there was a debate, and this is in 1962 when Kip Thorne was a graduate student and he joined Wheeler's team. At that point, there was a man named Roger Penrose, and I guess a lot of physicists have heard about him. He was a brilliant mathematician. The Penrose family, that they wanted their children to be doctors, because I believe Papa Penrose was a doctor, and I believe the mother was something like a doctor, or the father was a professor and the mother was a doctor. So when Roger Penrose told his parents he wanted to study math, they were horrified. But when they took him to a university to have him tested, he scored brilliantly in the test and defied all odds and solved all the problems on the test, where the professor said maybe he could solve one or two. But he solved all of them. So he had brilliance in mathematics. So he went on to study mathematics. But during his studies, his brother, who was a PhD in physics, he was studying physics. And he connected him with another physicist. And right away, Roger Penrose and this physicist connected. And Roger Penrose started thinking about the problems of astronomy. And with his strong mathematical background, especially in topology, which is the study of how surfaces are connected. For example, what's the topology? What's the form of a donut? What's the form of a coffee cup? Well, they're similar because they have a big hole in them. So I guess it's like maybe geometry, maybe. I'm not sure. But topology is the study of surfaces and how they're connected. So this study in mathematics, he would spend coming decades with his one foot firmly planted in mathematics and the other in physics, because he had studied mathematics in his PhD, but now he was introduced to the world of astronomy. So this, it was Roger Penrose that came up with a singularity theorem, and it had sweeping power. It said, once light rays go inside a singularity, nothing can prevent the gravity from growing so strong that, once the most amazing thing about the singularity theorem was its sweeping power. It dealt not solely with idealized imploding stars that have special idealized properties. This is what the Russians were criticizing the Americans for, that the stars must be precisely spherical or have no pressure. And this, the Russian argued, these idealized assumptions were the thing that were allowing the mathematics to talk out and say, yes, we can have a singularity. But Roger Penrose came up with a theory that dealt not solely with stars, whose initial random deformations were tiny, but with every imploding star imaginable, and thus undoubtedly with the real imploding stars that inhabit our universe. So the new tool that helped Penrose prove this was topology. The topology, which is a branch of mathematics that deals with the qualitative ways in which things are connected to each other. So, for example, a coffee cup and a donut have the same topology, because if they are both made from putty, we can smoothly and continuously deform one into the other without tearing it, without changing any connections. But a sphere has a different topology than a donut. If you have to deform a sphere into a donut, you have to tear a hole in it, thereby changing how it's connected to itself. But topology cares not only about connections and not about shapes or sizes. Only about connections and not about shapes or sizes or curvature. So, for example, the donut and the coffee cup have very different shapes and curvatures, but they have the same topology. So, before Penrose, physicists ignored topology because they were fixated on the fact that space-time curvature is the central concept of general relativity, and topology cannot tell us anything about curvature. But Penrose, being a mathematician, he had this strong mathematical background, and he, just like Einstein did about a century ago, before he developed the general relativity, he had to study up on his mathematics. And this is what Penrose was a genius in mathematics. So he brought topology into the discussion of black holes, and these issues were so important, and the mathematics of topology were so powerful in dealing with them, that by introducing the world to topology, Penrose triggered a revolution in the study of black holes. So this was in the mid-1960s, so during the mid and late 1960s, physicists like Penrose, Stephen Hawking, Robert Garrock, George Ellis, and other physicists like our William Unruh here at UBC, a renowned physicist whose contributions to the field of black hole research is important. So all these people taking off from Penrose's seminal ideas, combining topological and geometrical tools for general relativity calculations. These created a new set of tools called global methods. So using these methods, Hawking and Penrose in 1970 proved without any idealizing assumptions that our universe must have had a space-time singularity at the beginning of its Big Bang expansion. And if it one day recollapses, it must produce a singularity in the Big Crunch. So scientists, that was a big theory or big field, I think, years ago. That's what I heard about, the Big Crunch. But I guess scientists now believe the universe will expand forever, and the end of all time, we will have a big rip where atoms will be ripped apart. So in 1970, Hawking invented the concepts of a black hole's absolute horizon and prove that the surface area of absolute horizons always increase. So with these, the Americans, with Wheeler, with Penrose, with Hawking, just to name a few, and our esteemed professor here, William Unruh, they were at the forefront of developing the theory of black holes. But when we return to 1965, the stage was set for a momentous confrontation. So Isaac Kalitnikov and Evgeny Lifshitz in Moscow, had proved, or so they thought, with their mathematics, that when a real star without random internal deformations implodes to form a black hole, it cannot create a singularity at the center of the hole. Well, Roger Penrose in England had proved that every black hole must have a singularity in its center. So there was a confrontation in 1965 in a London conference at the third International Conference on General Relativity and Gravitation. So that was for these people that had the biggest brains in the world. This was the first opportunity at such a worldwide gathering for Isaac Kalitnikov and Evgeny Lifshitz to present the details of their proof that black holes do not contain singularities. So at that time in the 60s, the physicists like Kalitnikov, they were behind the Iron Curtain. They could not leave. So they had to be granted permission by the Soviet Union to go to the conferences. And between Stalin's death and the Gorbachev era, some of them were not allowed to go. So Kalitnikov at the conference wrote all his equations all over the blackboard, which extended the entire 50-foot width of the room. And what I'm going to do now, I'm going to close the show because I lost my last page of notes. But when I return next week, hopefully I can finish off. This Kip Thorne's book is so big and it's so wonderful, you can turn to any page and make a show of it. So today I made the show on the theory of black holes and how it apparently developed. And as I said, back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, there were no books on black holes. There was no Wikipedia. There was no internet. We could not go and access so much of the knowledge that we could today. So I can go to the library here, get a book on black holes. A five-year-old probably knows what a black hole is. But in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s, they were developing these theories. And there was a lot of assumptions they made. And it took time to battle it out. So when I return, I'm going to return to the battle of 1965, where the Russians were finally allowed to leave the Soviet Union. And in a London conference, they presented their theories that a singularity could not form, whereas Americans, after Penrose's analysis and his theory, they triggered a revolution in the books. Is our research, that means the Western research, not me, but all the brilliant, brilliant minds of our world were now, there was a revolution in black hole research. So when I return, we're going to talk about this revolution and have more fun talking about black holes. This is Marco. You've been listening to Astro Talk on 101.9. Have a nice week and bye-bye.